Minorities in Focus is made possible through a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Foundation in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Humanities.
First came here because there wasn't too many black people here when I came. And you could go downtown and stay all day long and not see a black face.
Way back there, I did everything. Mop floors, wash windows, wash people's clothes, all those kind of things to make some money. And surviving. I think it started to change a little bit better in the 50s, began to get better. Not so much that you could really shake a stick at it.
This program is the first of three, which will focus on the black experience in Minnesota, past and present, with projected visions and hopes for the future. Minorities in Focus presents Blacks in Minnesota, the past. The historical development of blacks in Minnesota began in the early 19th century, about four decades before Minnesota Territory became a state. It may surprise many Minnesotans today to learn that slavery existed within the boundaries of what is now the state of Minnesota. In fact, Dred Scott, one of the most celebrated slaves in the annals of American history, lived at Fort Snelling for 2 years. This post, which was founded in 1819 at the junction of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, was the first spot in Minnesota occupied by white pioneers. It was also the first place in the state to be settled by blacks. And for the most part, they were blacks in bondage to white masters. Two acts of Congress legally protected the unorganized territory of Minnesota from slavery. The first was the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which forever forbade slavery from existing in the Northwest Territory. The portions of Minnesota east of the Mississippi was protected by the ordinance. The western part of Minnesota was protected from slavery by the Missouri Enabling Act of 1820. Regardless of these laws, slaves were sold in Minnesota. Lawrence Taliaferro, a slaveholder from Virginia, arrived at Fort Snelling in 1823. Taliaferro had been appointed by Congress as the agent for the Dakota Indians in the territory of Minnesota. The records show that Taliaferro stayed at Fort Snelling for 20 years. He brought with him a number of slaves, leased some and sold a few, and kept a retinue of them in his household. Taliaferro slaves were estimated to be worth at least $30,000. Taliaferro made and recorded this observation of the Indians' feelings towards blacks. Indians thought much of Negroes and called them black men of Frenchmen, Wasi Chi Sepo. They would meet and laugh heartily with these black Frenchmen. Before the Civil War, less than 400 blacks inhabited the territory of Minnesota. Despite this background, blacks very early made their presence felt in the history of Minnesota. They functioned in a variety of capacities, as scouts, voyagers, fur trappers, and linguists due to their friendship with the Indian peoples. Throughout the 19th century, a number of black individuals from the small black community gained notoriety for their deeds. One of them was Big Jim Thompson, a slave who later gained his freedom. Thompson came to Fort Snelling in 1827, accompanying a settler by the name of John Culberton. Thompson became fluent in the Sioux language and became an interpreter between Indians and whites. Jim Thompson was also a skilled carpenter and played an important role in building the first Protestant church in the territory. This meeting house was erected on Market Street in St. Paul, the present site of both the first Methodist and Central Park congregations. Brunson, a contemporary historian, has written of Thompson, noting that he was, quote, a pious man, and that the Indians thought much of him and received him with much apparent confidence and cordiality. Jim became well known to the people of St. Paul. By 1860, the population of blacks in Minnesota swelled to about 800. And at the time of the Civil War, nearly half of the male blacks joined a regiment to free their southern brother from slavery. After the war in 1865, among the political problems that enlisted the interest of Minnesota was Negro suffrage. Underlying the interest of suffrage was concern that paralleled the national movement for the 15th Amendment, a constitutional change granting voting rights to Negroes. At this juncture in Minnesota history, blacks were recognized as industrious and law-abiding people, eager to establish themselves as good citizens. The Minnesota legislature acted on suffrage in 1865. An amendment to the state constitution was put before the people to extend the vote to adult males, in effect, to give black men the right to vote. The measure was passed by the Republican legislature, but was voted down by the people. Thus, blacks failed to gain voting rights in Minnesota through the democratic process. The voters again voted down this reform in 1867. Governor Marshall insisted on the measure, and in 1868, the amendment was adopted by over 700 votes. Governor Marshall then invoked Lord Byron on behalf of his black constituency. For freedom's battle once begun, though baffled oft, is ever won. Blacks jubilantly held their first state convention in St. Paul in 1869 to celebrate this achievement and the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Mahmoud El-Khati is a teacher of black history, presently at McAllister College in St. Paul. He has done extensive research into the history of Minnesota and the role blacks played in that history.
Up until about 1860, there were roughly about 400 black people who lived in this state, a very small community. The whole community was small. It was a territory, up until 2 years before the Civil War. What's interesting about that is that blacks still made their presence felt, in spite of their small numbers. They participated in a variety of things. We know that George Bongo has a township called Bongo Township up in Virginia County in northern Minnesota, founded by a man who had come from the West Indies, and some of his descendants are still living there in the early 19th century. Blacks were slaves, and a number of people brought slaves out here. Perhaps the most celebrated slave in not only Minnesota history, but in the history of 19th century America was Dred Scott. Dred Scott was a manservant of a Dr. Emerson who came to Fort Snelling in the 1840s and stayed at Fort Snelling for 2 years and married a St. Paul lady, a black lady, Annie Robinson, and proceeded to go back to Missouri, which was under slave rule, slave laws, and sued for his freedom. It took about 10 years for it to happen, but ultimately In 1857, the most momentous Supreme Court decision of the 19th century was called the Dred Scott decision, in which Dred Scott sued for his freedom because he had lived as a free man for several years in Minnesota and in Illinois, and went back to Missouri on the basis of that to say that he lived as a free man, therefore he was free. Of course, the decision was what Frederick Douglass called that lying decision, which favored freedom. The man named Chief Justice Taney issued the statement, which reflected the meaning of that decision, when he said that we've considered these people for now near two centuries as inferior, or so far inferior that they have no rights that white men are bound to respect. In effect, that okayed slavery. That was a prelude to the Civil War. I mean, politically, it split the country wide open, because what it indicated is that a man could take his slave property anywhere, irrespective of the fact that Minnesota had laws restraining the spread of slavery in this territory. As I alluded to earlier, people brought their slaves with them, and while it did not look like the regimented system of the slaveholding South, for obvious reasons, you didn't have that kind of economy out there. Blacks did other sorts of things. They were not into cotton and into tobacco and into indigo and into the mass gang labor that existed in the South. They were, in fact, servants and were, in fact, claimed as property. Dred Scott wasn't known for anything in particular. I mean, he wasn't a freedom fighter or anything like that. But he was involved in the most significant legal case of the 19th century, right here in Minnesota. And in 1861, the Civil War, as you know, began when the South fired on Fort Sumter. Now, Minnesota happened to be the first state to send volunteers in defense of the Union. And among those volunteers was nearly half, we don't have good statistics on this, of the male population of black people who went south, too, to help free their brethren right from this state. You know, that's the black people in this country, in Minnesota, of course, it has a very interesting history, which ought to be considered in a more serious way in terms of everybody kind of has an idea of what happened in the border states and in the South with a great mass of black people. But there isn't a great deal known about areas of the country west of the Mississippi, other than California, and perhaps a few other places, of these smattering of blacks in these various areas, you know, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska. There were black communities out here dating back before the Civil War. So Minnesota has a very interesting history. When you look at the nameless group of people, consciously avoid talking about individuals yet. And we've got to avoid that whenever we can. I mean, true history is a history of ordinary people, not the exceptions.
It has been said that you can legislate laws, but you cannot legislate what is in a man's heart. In spite of the gains made by blacks with the passing of the right to vote and the Emancipation Proclamation and the numerous contributions made by blacks to Minnesota, racial prejudice and its consequences remained prevalent. Born and raised in Minnesota, Van White has lived on the north side of Minneapolis all his life. He describes the times and the community he grew up in.
You know, I was born in the Depression. So by the time I got to the point of recognizing, I didn't know, whether I was poor or anything. By the time I recognized it, I was 10 years old. And that's when my father died. And it was then that I began to realize what I heard Mom and and Dad talking in whispered tones, and Grandma, because Grandma was with me from the day I was born, and she never left. They would be whispering, "Lord, what are we going to do?" And I hear my grandma say, "Well, brought that piano all the way from Arkansas. I guess we're going to have to burn it." You know, and I don't know why, you know, I didn't know those kind of things. Why? It was so hard. We had to break up the piano to burn it to keep warm. That's how hard the times were. Well, by the time after my father died, then I began to realize some serious things. I'd go with my mother places. She'd do a little day work here to get enough food. And I'd get on my knees and scrub the floors for Mama because I wouldn't let her get on her knees. I'd do these kinds of things. We got on welfare, you know. It was really some hard things and times to swallow, but it give you some strength, because if your parents have that strength, it rubs off on you. You know, my brother and I, he's 2 years younger than I, and he and I would go down here by the river, and I'd get up on the coal truck, on the car, coal car, throw coal down. He'd put it in the sack, put it on the sled, and we'd be running. You know, we learn how to survive. Not to hurt anybody, but we would take, you know, couldn't help it. And we did these kind of things for the family. We just took what we needed, you know, like the coal and the potatoes would come in. We'd, you know, things like that. And we'd walk all the way from over in this area, all the way over on Plymouth, down where Cozy's is, to stand in line with two buckets. I don't care how cold it was, very, very cold we did this, with two buckets to get one of chocolate milk and one of white milk, and walk all the way back, because they had that kind of stuff too, commodity milk. Yeah, it was kind of tough, but I didn't know, you know, thought this is the way it's supposed to be. You know, you don't know that it's really bad when you're young. But when your mother and your grandmother are constantly telling you this isn't the way life should be, then you began to learn. The community was a very small amount of black people, and it was made up of people who were relatively poor. Some people say we're segregated ourselves, and others say that, you know, the system helped us segregate ourselves. But we lived pretty well in one, a few blocks, yeah, with just mainly blacks. And the family structure was such that it was extended from my family to, say, your family. Just that continuity was a continuous thing. The respect of your mother and father, I had to respect your mother and father as if I was respecting my own, because they would chastise us, they would see that we did right, no matter where we were. So it was that intermingling of thought and action amongst the black family that I grew up in, which I really want to see come back again. And my mother and grandmother would say, when you're in school, go there and learn. Go like a sponge. Sit there. Learn. You don't care whether they like you or not. Learn. Listen. Learn. Get it all up here. Because they can't take it away from you if you can get it.
Everybody's working in this town, and it's worth me night and day. Everybody's working in this town, and it's worth me night and day. Just that mean working too. I'd work for the WPA. Well, when the landlord come this morning, and he knocked on my door, he asked me if I was going to pay my rent no more. He said, you have to move if you can't pay. And then he turned and he walked slowly away. So I have to try. Find me some other place to stay. That house wrecking crew's coming from the WPA.
I came face to face with the idea that blacks were janitors, blacks were porters, blacks were waiters, blacks were shoe shiners, blacks did all forms of menial work. This is the kind of thing that faced me when I graduated from high school. Way back there, I did everything. Mop floors, wash windows, wash people's clothes, all those kind of things to make some money and survive. I think it started to change a little bit better in the 50s. Began to get better. Not so much that you could really shake a stick at it.
Dolly Spencer, now 76 years old, migrated to Minneapolis from Oklahoma. A resident for 36 years, she describes her early experiences in Minnesota.
I came to Minneapolis in 1940. And I'd come here. My brother lived here at that time, he and his wife. And I just came on a visit. And then I liked so well, so I went back and sold my home and moved here. It was very, very hard when I first came here because there wasn't too many black people here when I came. And you could go downtown and stay all day long and not see a black face. And it was very hard for me to find work here when I came. In long in the 40s, and even the early 50s, work was hard to find for blacks. They'd have ads in the paper, but when you went there, they would tell you you could call up when you first, before you went down, you could call up, and they'd ask you, they wouldn't ask you your color, but they'd say, yes, the job is open. And when you got down there, it just was filled.
In the 1960s, when blacks throughout the country, in their continuing struggle for civil rights, were rallying to the cry, "We shall not be moved," Dolly Spencer was among those who went to Selma, Alabama, to join the march to Montgomery in support of human rights. She talks about the march and her reasons for going.
That was something to see. I shall never forget it. We marched from out on that highway to Montgomery, Alabama. And as far as you could see up above you were people, and as far as you could see behind you were people in there. I went because I thought that it was going to be something that would go down in history that I did for the black race, something that would benefit us in years to come. I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime, which is very surprising to me that I'm still alive and still able to march right today, because I was 68 then when I marched. But I went because I went for my children and my grandchildren and your children and your grandchildren. I was marching for the black race. Someday they would be free to have the same privilege and the same opportunities that the white children has got today. And I wanted my children's children to get it if nobody else did. It affected Minnesota. It affected Minnesota's whites as much as it did out there.
How?
Down there. I think it put them to thinking. And I do think it brought them closer together, closer to realizing that the black man had been mistreated.
How did blacks in Minnesota survive despite the hardships, despite the roadblocks placed in their path?
If I remember something I read a long time ago, that the Indian fought and died. The black man laughed and laughed and multiplied. He laughed at his problems. That is the name of the game. Is the passing down of how to survive. Young people should go to their grandmothers and let them tell them how they survived. Because they survived under far more oppressive hand than there is now. Far more. The oppression was so hard and heavy when my grandmother came up and my mother came up. And I don't know if some of us could survive under that. But you had to learn. You had to be the spook to sit by the door. You had to be the one in the field. You had to be the one passing messages out of the house to the one in the field. You had to do that in these communities. These are the kind of things. Blacks have to understand. We have to survive, and we survive. The key is by helping one another. That's how we survive.
This has been part one of Blacks in Minnesota. You've heard just a portion of the black experience. In part two, we will focus on Blacks in Minnesota, the present. The opinions expressed here are entirely those of the participants of the program and do not reflect those of the Minnesota Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.